Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Southern California, earning a BS in Business Administration from Utah State, while being a four-year starter in football for them. He was the Detroit Lions quarterback for 10 seasons from 1980 to 1989. In 2000, his 15-year-old son, Jeff, died by suicide. The author of Real Men Do Cry, today he's an outreach specialist for the Eisenhower Center, a residential wellness facility. His name, Eric Hipple. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the former Lions quarterback, Eric Hipple. Eric, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can we talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I grew up, I was born in Texas, but I grew up in Southern California. And my father was a salesman. First worked in the oil industry, and then worked for an environmental company that did cleanup of oil spills and around the frontage of Long Beach area, and it was pretty interesting. Got to see some pretty cool stuff, an explosion of a tanker that blew up, and then of course I think a big oil slick, and so some neat stuff growing up. But he was wonderful, supportive father that never pushed me anything, but supported everything that I did. And when I went to play football, I think it was something he always wanted me to do because he kind of lived his life through that portion of it. And it was wonderful father to have. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, up early in the morning, fixing breakfast every morning. In fact, I remember I had French toast every morning in my high school for breakfast. She just made it so well, I didn't want anything else. But just a great family, wonderful supportive parents, and I miss my father. He died last year, and my mother's still alive.
Where did you get your love for football?
Actually, I think football came in the form of wanting to belong to something, because I wasn't a great athlete to start off with. So I was wanting to belong to something, a team. But you know what it was that really drew me to it was the equipment. It sounds really funny, but even when I played Little League Baseball, I wanted to be a catcher. I wanted to wear the mask. I wanted to wear the equipment, the shin guards. It was just cool. So then when football was around, wearing the helmet and the shoulder pads and the uniform, it was cool to have the equipment. And I liked to hit. I liked to be involved in stuff like that. So I always wanted to play defense. It wasn't so much offense that ever really turned me on. It was defense.
You went to Utah State. You got a BS in Business Administration. You played for them for 4 years. And then in the 1980 NFL Draft, in the fourth round, you get drafted by the Detroit Lions. What were your first thoughts?
Well, my first thoughts were I was happy to get drafted because at the end of being a four-year starter, I went and played in a post-bowl game, the blue-gray game, and I blew my knee out. And so the chances of my draft, I thought, really minimized, and I thought maybe I might not even get drafted, even though they had me rated as a first-round draft choice. And so sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, first round, second round, third round went by, and I didn't get a call. And then I got a call just before the fourth round, and I'll never forget, I'm getting drafted. This is great. Okay, who is this? And it was the Detroit Lions. And I remember the first thing that went through me was, oh. Because I knew nothing about Detroit. As a West Coast kid, I had visions of Seattle. Jim Hart, who I liked, who I followed, with the St. Louis Cardinals, they'd flow me out there, so I thought I might get drafted there. So Detroit wasn't even on my radar. But the fact that I got drafted, I was really excited.
So they bring you here. What were your first thoughts of when you touched down and experienced Detroit?
Well, Detroit, since I think they put us up in Birmingham and in Bloomfield Hills or Birmingham it was. And I remember driving to get the physicals, and it was beautiful. It was you know, that's one thing I didn't know anything about, you know, Michigan at all. It was just gorgeous. I mean, and I remember going down Maple, and then of course, you know, we played up in Pontiac area. And at that time, it was still kind of somewhat out in the country by Oakland University, is where training camp was. And Michigan was surprising. It was beautiful. The people were extremely nice, you know. And coming from Southern California, where everybody has their own agenda, it was a really nice environment to be around.
It's October of 2011. You're a third-string quarterback. And we're going to play the Bears on a Monday night game. Changed your life. What happened?
It did change my life, and it was the starting quarterback, Danielson, had broken his hand. The backup quarterback played for two games, didn't play very well, and then on this Monday night call, on the Monday night game, I get a phone call, we're going to start you, Eric, and the first thing that popped my head was, oh my gosh, this is going to be like on national TV, my first start. And then a little bit of excitement was because my parents are going to get a chance to see the game, and so will everybody, all my friends and stuff, will get a chance to see my first start. But that anxiety, you know, of anticipation of how's it really going to go? Am I good enough? You know, you think you are, but you really don't know. And so it was going all the way up until about 9 o'clock when the game started. I was on my knees praying, you know, just don't let me embarrass myself. You know, just let me get through this, more or less. And it worked out really, really well.
We were 2-4. The Bears were very strong. It worked out very well. What actually happened?
Opening pass was a 40-yard completion to Freddie Scott, and the place just went wild. And I think from that moment through about half the first half of the game, I blinked and it was like almost gone. And yet when the game was over with, I had thrown for four touchdown passes. One of those was a 94-yard touchdown pass, which is the longest in football Monday night history at the time until Brett Favre broke it. But and I ran for two touchdowns. There was a lot of audibleizing that were going in the game, so you know, I had command over what was happening, and it was just, I mean, it was a magical night. I didn't sleep for 3 days afterwards. I mean, it was a magical night. Everything just kind of broke, you know, perfectly, and it was a fantastic game.
We're talking Eric Hipple. When we come back, we'll ask him what it's like being an NFL quarterback when you're 22, 25 years old. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Eric Hipple, who was the quarterback for the Lions for 10 seasons, from 1980 to 89. Eric, what's it like being 25 years old and being an NFL quarterback?
It is pretty amazing. You've got the world by the tail, and the world is pretty much yours, as far as, especially in a town like Detroit, because it's such a sports-oriented town, that anywhere you go, any place, you know, people that you see, you know, they're all patting you on the back. You know, they're all, you know, over here, they all want to be part of the scene, especially if you're successful and made a big splash like I had. And it's a blue-collar town, you know, and that's exactly, you know, what I was. You know, I was a guy who just liked mixing it up. I liked to scramble, you know, known for being tough, get knocked down, get back up again. And it just fit into this town, and it's just a great, really, you can almost do no wrong. You know, any place you go, it's wide open for you.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. The 85 Bears defense, the famous 46 defense, changed the game. Talk to us about that Bears defense.
It did. In fact, my big breakout night was just the beginning of that Bear defense, because they're still trying a lot of different defenses, and we just happened to hit them, you know. And as it morphed into the defense that became the 85 Bears defense, the 46 defense was the toughest, meanest defense to play against, because they blitzed. You know, and you couldn't tell if they're going to blitz, and so you have to protect yourself. When you protected yourself, then you drop back off in the zone, and then it's just almost impossible to throw against, because you only got two receivers going out. And, you know, and they were I mean, they had some athletes on that field too, and so there's nothing you do. I mean, it was they beat you up really bad. It was a tough defense, but it did change the course of the NFL, I believe, that defense did, because it forced teams to have to spread their offense out so they could actually see what the defense was doing. And because of that, I think the spread offense is what all of a sudden was the result of that, which we know today has changed. You know, I mean, that's what the game is today. It's all spread out.
The middle linebacker, Mike Singletary, was legendary for those eyes. When he looked right at you with those eyes, what did you think?
Not only would he look at you with those eyes, but he also had anticipation. So he had this habit of just before the ball was snapped, he would like jump forward, like so you know he's coming. You know, and with that pressure defense, you know, whether he was coming up or, you know, on a blitz, on a stunt, or scooping sideways, and so he's always making the tackle. He was just so active, you know, and yet he was so intelligent that he knew where to go, knew what to do, and he did his homework, and he knew that, whatever you're lining up in, offensive-wise, he could anticipate what play you were going to run.
They say once in a generation, a person comes along that tilts the football field. A Jerry Rice, etc. The Bears had that in Sweetness, Walter Payton. Mm-hmm. But your last year with the Lions, there's a rookie running back by the name of Barry Sanders that tilted the field. Talk to us about Barry Sanders.
Barry Sanders is such an amazing person and an amazing athlete that he actually took an offense that was not designed for him and made it his own, and it changed the course of that offense. I'm speaking specifically on the spread, you know, the run-and-shoot offense, which was designed to have a big back behind it to help protect the quarterback, and it could have, you know, the short-term runs, but not designed. What he did, he took that and made it his own. It's because everybody spread out in the run-and-shoot offense that nobody could get him one-on-one. Nobody can tackle them. Nobody could tackle them if they were 2-on-1. They had trouble tackling if there was 3-on-1. And so when you spread everybody out, he created his own lanes. He could run sideways as fast as he could frontwards. He could jump backwards and cut sideways. He was just such an amazing athlete. That whole offense centered around him, even though it was not designed for him. You know, and don't forget, I came in with Billy Sims, who was a Heisman Trophy winner, amazing running back in his own right, but a different type, which is a pounding type running back. And there's Barry, who I don't think anybody ever really touched him or tackled him one-on-one, ever.
You would watch him where there'd be 5 guys on the ground that missed him, and he only gained 2 yards. Did you just keep saying, wow, wow, wow?
Well, you know, the short term I had a chance to work with him, it was exactly. You'd hand the ball off to him, and typically you're supposed to carry out a fake, you know, afterwards, like, you know, pass or something. You couldn't do it. You just had to watch him. I mean, that's how amazing he was. You gave him the ball, and you're transfixed by him. And you'd watch guys just whiff, buckle at their knees. You'd watch guys, their eyes get really big because they're trying to figure out what's going to, and they would just be frozen. It's like deer in, you know, the deer in the headlights look. And that's exactly what the defense looked like when he was running.
When he would score, he would just hand the ball. He's a very quiet man. What was he like in the locker room and on the sidelines?
He was very unassuming and very quiet as well. And in fact, you know, there was maybe even a little bit of complaint, maybe by some players that wished he would have stepped up and become, you know, that big leader, you know, that pulls people with him. But that just wasn't who he was. Who he was this actually gentle person who was just, you know, had this gift that he was so appreciative of. And so never pushed, you know, never taunted anybody. He didn't care about records. You know, he just did his thing as part of a team.
Your last year was 89 with the Lions, so you went through that adjustment of no longer being an NFL star. Talk to us about the adjustment an NFL player makes when he gets cut and or retires.
That transition is probably one of the toughest things that a person could go through. And I say that because from the time you're probably, you know, 7, 8 years old, you start in this whole thing of football, and if you perform, then you get to be on the field. If you perform, you get to be the starter. If you perform, you know, people get to pat you on the back. And so everything's surrounded about this performance piece and about the identity and who you are. And that goes through all the way through college. It goes through high school. It goes through college. And if you're lucky enough to make it in the pros, it's certainly surrounded in pros. And you live in a bubble. In that bubble, you never know when it's going to end, but you never see it ending either. And yet the day that it does, it's just boom, you lose your identity, You lose your income. You lose your relationships because you're not connected anymore. You can't walk back in the locker room. You lose your medical support because all your doctors and stuff that you had are part of it. And then your relationship changes completely at home, you know, with those people around you who used to, you could do no wrong. And all of a sudden now you're just one of them and you're a person and you make mistakes. And now you're being called out on your mistakes. And that is a total shift of who you are to what you are now. And it is very tough to get through. It's traumatizing.
From 90 to 94, you worked for Fox as an analyst. So you watch Sanders every week. What was it like going from playing to now in the booth and watching?
Well, you know, first I started a business, and the business I threw myself into, nothing about it, but I learned on the fly. And so I was successful in that business, you know, 5-6 years, you know, into it. And so from 95 to 2000, it was an extension of me actually, I think, trying to reconnect with football again. You know, so I'm going to try to reconnect, and the opportunity came up. And so from 95 to 2000, being on the field, being, you know, talking about football, being able to look at the films, and being able to watch, you know, being part of it was a reconnection for me. And watching Barry from whatever point of view I had, but now I got a chance to watch films as well. And man, a whole nother, this guy is totally amazing. And but it was that reconnection, I think.
We're talking to Eric Hipple. When we come back, we'll ask him about a day in 1998 that changed his life and an awful lot of other lives. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Eric Hipple, the author of Real Men Do Cry, which discusses his NFL career, his bouts with depression, and details the warning signs of teens who have died from suicide. Let's go back 1998. Your wife, Shelley, is driving you to the airport, going down 275. She's going about 80 miles an hour, and you hand her a little napkin. What did it say?
I said, I'm sorry, I love you, and I opened up the door, and I jumped out of the car, hit the pavement, probably going about 70 miles an hour, you know, and tumbled 70, 75 miles an hour. You know, and looking back on that, you know, it's so hard for me to be in that mindset again, but, you know, I was looking at this, what was happening at the time, and I was making more money than I made in football, you know, in 96. And yet that draw of wanting to reconnect. And so from 95 to 2000, you know, I did reconnect. But part of that reconnection back to football also left, really highlighted that hole that was there still from that transition that was there. And I just felt like, is this it? What I'm doing now isn't like what I did then. And my whole identity, you know, from that transitional piece started suffering. The business started falling apart. And as it fell apart, you know, depression, motivation, actually, that's probably what caused the business to start falling apart. Just lack of pleasure in anything I tried to do. And nothing just felt alive again. And so some of that reconnection back in the NFL, through the Fox Sports, also, I think, showed how big that hole really was. And as I fell into that hole, I just felt like I just wasn't worthy anymore, you know, and things fell apart. And I just felt, you know, my wife and family would be better off without me. That's how worthless I felt.
Let's jump ahead a few years. And you've got a son, Jeff, the apple of your eye. Tell us about your late son, Jeff.
Well, the sad thing is, you know, through this transitioning pieces and stuff towards the end of my career, I'd gone through a divorce. And so, you know, Jeff and his sister had moved back with their mom to Utah. And we had a great relationship. And so Jeff had come out with him, live with me a year, then go back and live with. So his transitions he was having on his own. The trouble with not seeking treatment myself after the event that I had is that I didn't learn anything. And so when Jeff was here as a freshman in high school, which is a transition in itself, he was doing extremely well, you know, and so this is how it's supposed to be, this is how it's supposed to go, and things are wonderful. But when, you know, it hit him in that transition and depression, not feeling well, not feeling good, lack of motivation, sleep issues, concentration, his grades started to fall. He started isolating away from his friends, and just you know, spending time in his room and didn't want to go anywhere. And I didn't know how to handle that because I didn't have, never learned anything from when I went through it. And so, hell, you get through this, you know, I got through it. But I never thought in his mind, you know, a youth person's mind, a child's mind, that they could think about death the way that I had as an adult. And so that never even came across to me that he could be thinking that way.
On April 4th, 2000, he was killed by suicide.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I had a Dr. Bill Ritter, a pastor, legendary pastor on Maple Avenue, big church, whose only son, a lawyer, also died of suicide. And Dr. Ritter said, Jack, I believe that the first heart to be broken at Bill's death was God's heart. What are your thoughts?
I think any time we lose an innocent soul, that God's heart is broken. Especially when they're entrusted to, you know, the families, the people here, their friends. You know, how could one fall through the gap and fall through and have their life feel like it's not worth living and have that happen? I think that breaks God's heart because we are meant to be connected. We're meant to be in relationships. We're meant to nurture each other and reach out to each other. And when a person falls through the gaps and feels that way and takes their life, somewhere something went wrong and he wasn't supported. And I think that hurts.
You then started to drink heavy. And I think on a way home from a Lions game, you get picked up, DUI. You get thrown in the clinker for 58 days. And the supernatural, God sends an angel to you. The supernatural, Lem Barney, what did he do?
Yes, when I was in there, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I wouldn't let any family come by. I mean, I was in such a deep spot, deep hole. That I just didn't care about life, you know, but you can't take my life. I can't take my life now because I know what it's like, you know, for other people. I know what that feels like. So didn't talk to anybody, didn't want to see anybody. I rejected Lem Barney before. And then somewhere I had this feeling, and part of it was looking at the guys that were around me that were in jail and saying, you know, I don't want to be this, you know. And so I allowed Lem to come by, and he brought a Bible with him. He sat down, he prayed with me, and he left the Bible behind. And I went back into, you know, started opening it up and started going into areas that I haven't really visited in quite a while. And it was that spot there that gave me hope, that said, you know, you're here, but you have the choice to get out of here. What are you going to do with it? And I prayed real hard. And it was that connection. The spirit that just said, you know, there are answers out there and you can make a difference. And the first thing you have to do, though, is make a difference on yourself. You know, you got to help yourself heal. And that's where it began.
It's a miracle, a transformation, to see you today. How did it happen?
It happened with a lot of support from a lot of people. It happened because I was willing to, when you hit a bottom and say, listen, you can make some choices here. The one thing that God gave us, which is the greatest thing in the world, besides his son, was he gave us free will. You get to choose. You can choose this or you can choose that. And I chose to choose him and follow those choices, being responsible for my life, you know, opening myself up. I joke about my sister because she always uses the word surrender in her own mission. And it was really hard to swallow that word surrender because, you know, in football and in, you know, in a man's world, it means, you know, giving up. That's what surrender means. It means, you know, and yet, in a way, the way we worked through the way I worked through it was, instead of using the word surrender, let's use the word acceptance. And so that's a positive statement in my mind. I accept this. And I accept your will. I accept the gifts that you're giving me. And I want to use those gifts.
If there's a mom or dad listening tonight, Eric, who's recently lost a child to suicide, what do you say to that mom and dad?
The first thing I would say to them is you cannot heal and cannot grieve with guilt. So remove any guilt that you have. We know that, you know, we love our kids. And that means we would do anything possible to save their lives, and we do. It's just we maybe not, didn't have the right information. The circumstances dictated to where we couldn't have been there. So guilt is huge. You have to remove the guilt to move forward. And then it's, what are you going to do with this information? Do you go and help heal others? Do you honor the person that you lost because you're going to do something proactive? Or do you stay as a sorrowful victim that says there's nothing and hate and remorse and get angry at God? None of that helps. The only thing that does help is moving forward and proactive and opening up yourself to the possibilities that exist.
Keith Famey, his latest documentary is Death is Not the Answer. It's going to air on November 11th at 8 p.m. on Detroit Public TV. Death is Not the Answer. You were involved with that mission.
Yes, well, you know, it's, you know, the... You know, and a little bit of the, throw a little of the science in there. Even you know, the brain itself, you know, is a problem solving tool. I mean, it loves to solve problems, and if we allow the possibilities through choice and through God and through the things that are available to us, then you know we can make those positive changes and make those positive choices. But if we don't do that, then what happens is we get stuck, right? And so, to a solution to feeling overwhelmed, a solution to feeling worthless, a solution to feeling that there is no solution becomes only one solution, which is death. We're here to say that death is not the answer. There are so many solutions that we have to open ourselves up to the possibilities, and it's really hard to do when we're thinking about death. And so we have to remove that as a solution and say there are always other answers. And sometimes that takes other people stepping in. Sometimes opening yourself up to the possibilities that are before you. Sometimes maybe turning yourself over, you know, the surrender we talk about, and to letting those possibilities happen.
We're talking to Eric Heppel. When we come back, we'll ask him about our veterans and the fact that 33 a day are dying of suicide. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Eric Heppel, who today is an outreach specialist for the Eisenhower Center, a residential wellness facility situated on a ranch outside Ann Arbor, Michigan. Eric, our vets, young heroes, true heroes, talk to us about their adjustment.
Well, you know, our young heroes, you know, they volunteer for this position. You know, it's a volunteer army, volunteer service, and they put themselves into harm's way in the greatest sacrifice of all, which is they take an oath that they will die for us. And that is huge. Just that in itself, you know, is a gift. And so, you know, when they come back, when they go through their transition, some of the same transitions that exist as far as wearing a uniform, their identity, you know, their structure, and also going to a non-structured environment. It's a tough adjustment, especially if they've been injured or if they've gone through some sort of trauma. And when you talk to the veterans, they're not victims. Okay, they volunteered for this. And so we should honor that and not say, well, you know, our poor veterans. They're not victims in this area. Okay, the unfortunate thing is, just like any other transition, and also if they can befall to depression and substance use and all the things that we talked about, that's some of the stuff that I went through. And how do you deal with that? And so for that, we need to reach out and support them. We need to be there for them just like they were for us, regardless if they did combat or not. It doesn't matter. They volunteered for this position to be there. And so that transition is a tough one. And so some of the ones who go through combat, some of the post-traumatic stress, some of the changes in their living situation and relationships, like I talked about, we need to support them as well. And unfortunately, some of them come back, and when they're disconnected and they're isolated, then suicide becomes a possibility. And we lose too many of our vets today.
Today, you're outreach specialist for the Eisenhower Center outside Ann Arbor. Tell us about the Eisenhower Center.
The Eisenhower Center is an amazing place. And what it does, it's a neurocognitive behavioral for brain injury. However, because of their knowledge base and they're so good at what they do, they opened up this house. They're at the ranch called After the Impact, and it's set up for veterans and for former players as well to go and sit and connect together and go through therapy together and support each other through these issues. And, you know, from a selfish standpoint of view, it's great for our players and even for myself because we get a chance to service, to be of service to somebody who sacrificed so much. And so that's where we connect. You know, and some of the same issues and stuff, but it's this togetherness, the reconnecting again, I think is really the key to the therapy.
www.eisenhowercenter.com. Your book, Real Men Do Cry. What do you want us to take from that book?
The book was really designed to say you're not alone. There are things that people go through. And don't isolate. Reach out for support. You will get through this. You can get through this. And then there's some other things at the end of the book that are just, I take some examples of things that I've run across in my work in suicide prevention that I've come across and maybe how we can help reach out to somebody else and look at this from a different point of view or even yourselves if you look at something and say, wow, I never thought of it this way and maybe gives us a chance to all of a sudden move forward. And that's really what it was designed, you know, to do is that, you know, men are people, you know, and if we're part of the human condition, which is we have emotions and we have feelings, and not to hide them, not to always wear them on your sleeve either, but to acknowledge them because they're important.
We had another Lion quarterback by the name of Eric Kramer. And boy, your lives have intersected unbelievably. Talk to us about Eric Kramer.
Well, Eric Kramer, another quarterback who I really got the chance to know and watch as I was working for Fox TV and the pregame show and got to interact with him. And then he went into broadcasting afterwards, and so interaction was there as well. I got to know him through that. And then in his life, he lost his son. I interacted with that. He went through a nasty divorce. He lost his father. He lost his mother. He had some significant losses, and through that time, we had a chance to interact. He had a couple bouts of depression. We even did some presentations together. And so when he came to me for help, did the best that I could, and it was heartbreaking when I heard that he shot himself. The good news is that he survived. The great news about that, it's a miracle that he has hardly any deficiencies whatsoever. I mean, you wouldn't even know if you're a stranger walked up to him. And that is a miracle in itself. And he's out, and the greatest thing from this whole experience was his depression's pretty much gone. He knows life as a gift, and he plans on living it that way and sharing his experience.
You talk a lot about human connection today and its importance. And these young kids, there is no human connection because they're texting. Talk about the need for human connection.
And human connection means face-to-face and connection because that's where we pick up empathy. That's where we share and feel each other, right? And, you know, through technology is great because you can get so much information about anything that you want across the board. But if that information comes without any emotional content or whatever, then it's just left to the person who's receiving the information on the mood that they're in is how they receive it. And so they don't get a chance to see how it was sent or what the meaning behind it was or what the purpose of the message might be. And so if you're not doing very well and somebody, you know, sends you a message, depending on how you're feeling is how you accept it, not how they were designed and what they meant by when they sent it. And that's a problem because it allows us not to see another person's feelings get hurt or another person's get happy for what I say and the connection together. And that's the downfall of the technology. And so technology is great, but this human connection of the human beings is so important, you know, to our mental health, to God's plan, and to our future.
whether you've surrendered Eric Hipple or accepted, you've done a great job at it. If there's a listener today that says, Eric, I know I should. My life is all messed up, but I can't surrender or give acceptance.
Well, the first thing I'd say to that person, well, so you decided you're going to do it all on your own, and how's that working out for you? So, because that's really what happens. You know, we left to our own devices, we have a tendency to pick up mostly the negative, not to see the positive things about ourselves. We make bad decisions and we dwell on the bad decisions, not the good decisions that we make. And through hope is really where we're saved. And that comes through faith and moving forward and being open to this connection that we talk about and to a relationship with something more powerful than ourselves.
You've used the word miracle a couple times this evening. You're telling us that there are miracles today?
I believe there are. And regardless of sometime in the future, 1,000 years from now, we figure out that there's some science behind it or not, it's still a miracle today. And you have to have faith in that. So whatever is guiding that hand, guiding your life, if you open up to it, it is a miracle. From where I am today, from where I was, it's a miracle. Yeah, and I accept that.
Talking about the future, when you're in eternity and you see your son Jeff again, what do you say to him?
Ask him for forgiveness first. Open my arms up, if he'll have me. And then hopefully get a chance to share the future that I wish we would have had some here on earth. But eternity's much better.
Dad, he'll have you. He'll have you.
Thank you.
As our time winds down this evening, can you lead us in a closing prayer, please?
Sure. Dear Father, Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for the blessings that we have and the fact that we can enjoy this life that you've given us and share the relationships of those that you've placed in our pathways. We also are so thankful for the things that you've given us and we ask you that forgive us for our misgivings and maybe the decisions we've made that aren't in your will, left to our own devices. And through that forgiveness, then we ask you also for the blessings that will be before us and that we can live a life in your will and walk in your way. And we ask you to guide us and protect us. And we ask this in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Eric Hipple, what a shining example of a man who's let go and let God. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you very much for having me.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.